Hi, this is Jeff. You are listening to this. What is this? Well, this is that. And by that, I mean the Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea podcast. Brian and I decided that since we have finished all the books, the podcast will be different, even though it will really be the same. Over the past 2 years, Brian has given me a hard time about the length of the title of this podcast. Since we both have a fascination with the singular utterance Fenchurch made in the back of her brother's car, we decided to change the name of our podcast to that, or this. However, so those who may not listen to every episode will recognize it when they come back, I have kept the original name in the official title. So yes, I have made the name shorter and longer at the same time. Thank you for listening and continuing to listen. Welcome to this.
Far out in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy lies a small, unregarded yellow sun. Orbiting this at a distance of roughly 92 million miles is an utterly insignificant little blue-green planet whose ape-descendant life forms are so amazingly primitive that two of them still think doing a podcast called Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea is a pretty neat idea. These podcasters have, or rather, had a problem, which was this. Actually, this is the solution.
Hey, Brian, what's this?
This?
Yeah, this.
This, Jeff, is, or was, Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea.
Yes, it is.
Let's talk about this, because I think it's a fantastic new idea, don't you?
I do. I was kind of on the fence about it when we first started talking about it, because I didn't know if it mattered. And then I started playing around with the logo. And when I came up with that logo, I went, oh, we have to change the name now because I like the logo.
I do too. I like the logo, but even better, I like the idea of the change to the podcast.
Well, it's not going to be Hitchhiker's Guide anymore. It's going to be Hitchhiker's Guide Adjacent.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, that is the point. And for, I don't know that there'd be any listener at this point who doesn't know the origin of this.
Right.
But perhaps you'll remind us for any fresh new listeners.
Well, we both were completely fascinated and intrigued by the single word Fenchurch uttered in the back of the car when she woke up momentarily, which was this. And it's never explained. It never goes on. Nothing ever comes of it. And if we ever actually write something, that is going to be the subject matter.
That's correct. And of course, this, after she says that, her brother says, I don't know what she's talking about. It could be this pair of Don Alfonso's tweezers.
Right.
Remember? And we had the discussion about how all that came about. And
the rabbit hole you went down trying to find
absolutely.
Don Alfonso's tweezers.
But as you say, this represents the new rabbit hole. We've gone beyond Adam's created products. I mean, we're still going to stay with Adam's because we're going to get to Dirk Gently and the other works that we know that he's produced.
Yeah, Starship Titanic and some biographies and stuff like that too.
Exactly, exactly. But this new season, we are going to change the podcast name to this. And for a time being, we'll add the phrase, was Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea.
Right. And we're not changing any of our contact information.
No, that's fantastic.
So all of our listeners who have never contacted us can still not contact us at the same places.
This will make it easier.
Yes. For them not to contact us. We want to keep it simple for you not to contact us.
Oh my gosh.
If you have nothing to say, don't send it here.
And we'll hear you loud and clear, I promise.
Right.
Oh my gosh, Jeff.
So this episode, mm-hmm. we are going to talk about Hexagonal Phase, mm-hmm. which is the radio version of And Another Thing.
Which is written by Owen Coffer.
Yep.
And is an officially licensed vision of another book in the series.
Correct. And we've already talked about the book.
Yes, we have.
And when we talked about it, there were a couple of things that were bouncing around in my mind that I was trying to reconcile, and I thought I figured something out, but I really didn't.
Okay.
One of the things that frustrated us about the book, and obviously this, because it's still the same property, mm-hmm. is how much changed in a very seemingly short amount of time between when we last saw them mm-hmm. and now.
Right.
One of the things was Wowbagger's ship.
Yes.
And he came down and he insulted Arthur. And I'm like, oh, okay. He came at prehistoric Earth. So right. that was really 2 million years ago. Right. A lot can happen in 2 million years.
That's correct.
But then I thought, oh, wait. He showed up on the burning pitch at Lord's Cricket Grounds to insult Arthur Philip Deodat, who was Agrajag. Mm-hmm. And the ship was described as long, sleek, and silver with the same long legs that it was 2 million years ago.
Right.
So he didn't get Thor's ship in that 2 million year time period. He got it between the destruction of the Earth mm-hmm. and whatever is happening, however long in the future that has been. Less than 10 years, I believe they have said.
Yes. Yes, and I know we talked about the time frame of the previous novel and how long that physically took for the individuals that are involved with that.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good question about the ship, because as we know in the story that Coffer wrote, this ship was given to Thor by Odin. And Thor didn't really like the ship because it was too adoring of him.
Clingy.
Something like that. Clingy. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Clingy. Yep. So that is an excellent question. I mean, we don't have an answer for that, but we did talk about it.
Right.
Well, Jeff, I have to tell you, when you suggested we listen to this radio show, I had all kinds of trepidation.
Well, yeah. Yeah, me too.
I really didn't think that I could sit through it. And that was without even listening to the first words. But I have to tell you, I think as we analyze the version that the BBC put out, it's given me a different perspective.
I will agree, I think, because I believe that this story benefited with cutting out 20 hours of garbage. Mm-hmm. When you took a 24-hour story and cut it down to 4 hours or whatever, mm-hmm. it was perfect.
Yeah, and I have one other thought as to why my opinion of this radio show is different than my opinion of the book. And it's a simple thought, and perhaps I could start with this.
Yeah.
It's the writer, Dirk Maggs.
Okay.
Dirk Maggs is the individual who is quoted as being the director and writer of the BBC series here.
Okay, yes.
And as you know, and as we know, Dirk Maggs was a contemporary of Douglas Adams.
Right.
He was involved with the original radio show. He was probably doing some of the editing, if not some of the actual writing, for the Douglas Adams version.
Correct.
So I'm going to give all my kudos to Dirk for making this radio show much better than the book.
I will agree, and I will give him the credit too, because here's a couple of examples, or an example of how I figured that out. I was playing the That Wasn't in the Book game again.
Oh, gosh, don't start that.
Radio series.
This was so fraught. I mean, I stopped my pencil like 100 times, Jeff, because I was like, oh, no, I don't want to say that because I know I'll be wrong.
Well, here's what I mean. Mm-hmm. I would be listening to the program. Something would be said or something would be done. It would be clever. It would be funny. It would make me laugh. And I think that couldn't have been in the book. And then I would go back. And it was. But okay. The way it was presented in the book, usually in a guide note that had 5 minutes of talk before it and 5 minutes of talk after it.
It was diluted.
It got lost. The joke completely got lost. And so I point out a lot of jokes that are in the book as being funny here because they were funny here.
Right.
Or they weren't necessarily funny in the book, even though they were funny. It just got lost.
Right, exactly. And there's significantly less, as you point out, in the parenthetical areas of the BBC show. And that is one of the biggest complaints I had about the book.
Right, right. They could have done a 6-part series of all just the parenthetical points in the original book.
And I would have cried and gone to bed in the fetal position.
Yes. Season 4 of our podcast will be called Guide Note.
The things that I didn't hear, right?
Yes. So the first episode starts out with a cold opening with a replay of the scene from the club at the end of Quintessential Phase.
Mm-hmm.
Where they do the Babel Fish is the only other, or other than the dolphins, and self-preservation. So they replayed that whole scene, so I knew they weren't going to change anything. I knew that they were setting up to have the same type of constructs.
Correct.
And then what do you know? There is a guide note right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to say the guide note is wrong or incorrect, but it's ambiguous and can be interpreted different ways.
Okay.
It states that Arthur's life went from the existentially singular to the temporarily plural after exposure to the guide. Well, it was kind of going to be that way regardless of the guide. Mm-hmm. So it's, wouldn't all of the Earths have existed with or without the guide and all of the destruction? So it's true, but it's kind of a weird, they're making it sound like it was a cause.
Right. You're right. I listened to that and then let it wash over me, you know?
Right. Yes. And at the end of the note, it does refer to this as a guide appendix and encourages the listeners to get extremely drunk, which I thought, oh, okay. They even know this is going to bother a lot of people.
Yeah, wouldn't that be an interesting drinking game?
Yeah. So during the introduction, we're reminded of all the characters and a very brief overview of what happened at the beginning. It was nice to hear Gag Halfront.
Yep.
He made an appearance in this.
That's right.
But they basically just want us to know that Vogon Jeltz is still trying to get rid of Earth and its inhabitants.
Right.
And the first joke that was in this that I thought was funny, that was actually in the book, is it talks about the different ways of destroying a planet. And it said, one planet killing device is pretty much the same as any other when you're on the receiving end.
Right.
Like, yes. Yes. And then the other thing I found very clever and kind of funny is it said, Trillian Astra now talks with the voice of Trisha McMillan.
Yeah, so they can fit the actor in there, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh my gosh. Of course, I didn't really take too many notes in this first episode, primarily because, as you say, it's a review. Most of the entire episode is, and it's about 30 minutes long, is a review of what's happened in the past, but there was one line where I just literally cracked up laughing. Trillian is reunited with Random.
Because this is all in the constructs.
Right. Right.
Right.
And Random is going on, and Trillian is getting annoyed. I guess we have to put up a little bit of frame here, because in the construct that was created by the guide to protect the individuals, to allow them some free will and give them a longer life. That's what we find out in this episode, that right. The guide has set up this construct, and each of the individuals here have been allowed to live their own lives. But in this life that was lived, Random got herself attached to a Flayboos by the name of Fertile, which is a yes. small furry creature, and they become husband and wife. And again, a little later on in the story, Trillian is being annoyed by Random, who's really doesn't like the fact that her husband has disappeared
right.
because of the transition to real time.
Right.
And Trillian shouts out, "Go tickle your gerbil."
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It just, I still just thinking about that line is making me laugh.
Yes. I think there's a lot of innuendo in this program from beginning to end.
Oh gosh.
So they play out all of these constructs, and of course it ends because of low battery. And the low battery thing never bothered me until you pointed it out.
Sorry about that.
It became further infuriating when you mm-hmm. realize that all of these constructs happened in the blink of an eye.
Yes.
So there was no real time. But yes, he exists, or the guide exists outside of time, so in theory, they could have gone to another dimension and lived that 100 years. But like you said, it's got to have some sort of way to regenerate power.
Yeah, so. We don't want to think about that anymore. Oh, but how about the big surprise in this episode?
I went from being totally offended that they would imitate to completely overjoyed.
Uh-huh. I know. That it was really I did the him. Same thing. Isn't that amazing? Amazing. Amazing. And who we're talking about?
We are talking about Stephen Hawking.
Isn't that amazing? Stephen Hawking. I did the exact same thing you did. When I first heard his voice, I'm like, how dare they? Yes.
How dare they imitate Stephen Hawking for their little radio mm-hmm. show?
And then
only to hear at the end.
Yep. There he is. He's actually credited and is part of this particular radio show. And for that reason alone, I'm going to suggest everybody out there, all 10 of you,
yes.
go out there and listen to this one episode.
Yes, just so you can hear Stephen, Professor Stephen Hawking,
mm-hmm.
as part of the Hitchhiker's universe.
I know.
As the voice of the Guide Mark II.
Incredible. Incredible.
They did something a little bit different here. The episode ends with the appearance of Zaphod.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of nobody recognizing him, Random blurts out, "I thought he would have two heads."
Yep. And you know what's funny about the two head, one head thing? Here in this episode, in the radio show, we have a clearer understanding of one other reason why he might have only had one head.
Okay.
In the book, I don't recall that this was made clear as it was in the radio show, that is, that the only reason Zaphod was back there at that particular Earth at that particular time was his intention to find another group of gullible people
yes,
to swindle group. Out of their money to get them to the Innisfree, his planet Innisfree.
Yes.
So here he is on his, as we learned in the book, this would have been at least his third group of people that he was looking for. And in the radio show, his original announcement is he's talking about Innisfree and Kong, is it? Is that the name of the
yeah.
city or the island or which that those individuals can be transported to? So right. that makes a little more sense. He's now trying to encourage all of the multidimensional human beings he can to make as much money as he can. So having one head makes that a little bit easier to do.
Yes, yes. So I think that the end joke after the credits of this episode is worth repeating.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes for this podcast as well. Listeners are reminded. The relaxed attitude to danger provided by Jujanta 200 super chromatic peril sensitive sunglasses is no substitute for running around screaming. So,
oh my gosh.
I love their little end jokes at the end.
Yeah, that's hysterical. That line. I knew you'd love that because I know you're a fan of the Jujanta sunglasses.
Yes, absolutely. So that brings us to part two. I had a lot of problems with how they presented the very beginning of this episode.
Yeah.
Because to me, it goes beyond misdirection to being plainly wrong. The beginning of the episode says that while the rest of the Earth is being torn apart by a latticework of Grebulon death rays, the group was rescued by Zaphod.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, immediately aboard the Heart of Gold, we find out that they are still trapped by the death rays. So they were not rescued by Zaphod. Mm-hmm. Zaphod appeared in the same trap that they were in.
That's true. Oh my gosh. And then they...
And then there's another part, the next part here. Like, if this is what you were going to say, go and
okay.
say it.
No, go ahead. But, go ahead.
And I don't know if I like this or don't like this, because this is another one of those, it's a little change from the book. Zaphod calls to the computer, and he calls, "Get us out of here, Eddie."
Oh, jeez. I didn't hear that.
Yes. So, Eddie is piloting the ship at this moment in the episode. And
mm-hmm.
we'll find out later that Left Brain is hooked up and all of that. But I don't well, we'll get to that when we get to that, because there's some other things that are said there that, again, kind of bugged me.
Right. I really only have one note for this chapter, and I think my note comes later. So why don't you give us a build up here and we'll see where we're at.
Okay. We have found out that Zaphod has only one head. And we know from the book that it's hooked up to the computer, and the Heart of Gold is flying much better now that his other head is doing all the calculations. Mm-hmm. But in this, Zaphod was talking about his other head and said, he couldn't get my head around the numbers. So here... His other head was having difficulty with the calculations, where in the book, so I don't know which version I like better.
Oh my gosh.
In this episode, they do a guide note that mentions mm-hmm. Zaphod having a third arm attached.
Right.
And they allude that it was for Eccentrica, so he'd have three arms and hands available.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that the origin of his second head is shrouded in mystery. And that's kind of all they say.
Yeah, I know. I know. Again, I heard that. It just added a piece to the puzzle, and I don't know. I don't know what to think about it.
And I am disappointed that they also kept the line from the book having Ford say, "You finally decided to take it off," since that implies he was not born with it.
Right. Right. And or that he actually had considered it in the past.
Right. And I want to know if this bothered you. So we get introduced to Left Brain, and his voice and speech patterns make him sound like an idiot when he's supposed to be the smart one.
Well, you know what's funny? The first time I listened to it, of course, I listened to it, I think, at regular speed. But then the second time I'm listening to it at double speed.
Okay.
And at double speed, he sounds a lot more like he's trying to imitate Elvis. And then, of course, when he's singing, as we're about to find out, he's definitely trying to imitate Elvis.
Yes, absolutely.
So this was the Elvis personality of Zaphod.
Right. Well, for some reason, it was karaoke night.
Yes.
Which at first, when the music started, I was against and I was just bracing myself.
Mm-hmm.
But then this became my favorite part of almost any episode of the radio series that we have listened to.
Yeah.
Because the transporter accident song being performed like it was a combination of Elvis, Meatloaf, and David Lee Roth all rolled into one just won me over. It was fantastic. So if you have to listen to two episodes, listen to episode two just to hear the Aldebaran is great transporter accident song.
Right. And the reason, one of the reasons that this song is being sung is because they say that that's what happened. There was a transporter accident. That's how the head got separated.
Is that what happened?
That's what they said in the episode.
Oh, see, that I missed. Mm-hmm. That, I don't know if I like that either. Well, he was just there with his head on the floor? I don't understand.
Oh, I think it's one of those ineffable mysteries that we're supposed to accept.
And Bob.
But it's ineffable.
Yes. So Ford's conversation with Zaphod, that crashed left brain before he could calculate the improbability needed to escape. But if you remember, it was already determined that they can't use the improbability drive this close to a gravity well.
Mm-hmm.
But now he's trying to calculate the improbability needed to escape.
Right.
Again, I don't like when you've almost got two back-to-back scenes that have mm-hmm. contradictory information.
Right.
In the book, Ford is talking to Left Brain about how him being rescued is a pattern. And the phrase that he uses that escaped me and got by me, and I don't remember you talking about it, he mm-hmm. just called it very organic being territory.
Right.
As in, a pattern is something organic beings do, not computers.
Mm-hmm.
Skip me. Totally went past me in the book.
Okay.
But here, in this, he was very, very blatant and just saying, it is you being an organic being hooked up to the computer that is influencing the patterns that is causing us to be rescued. So I liked how they took something that, to me, was buried in the book, but very important, and dug it out and said, this is what you need to know. And
right.
did it
right,
very blatantly. Exactly.
Right. I mean, it does fit pretty nicely, because we've been told, and it's, I guess, been proven, that it's impossible for human beings to create random numbers.
Correct.
Because of our, like you say, organic nature, we can't do that. And even at that, creating computer programs that truly create random numbers is a near impossibility.
Right. There is some sort of algorithm or pattern that could be predicted if you knew what it was.
Right, exactly. So that's a fascinating piece of this puzzle. But you know what's funny is that on top of that, there's the layer that I don't remember them exploiting in the book, and that is the fact that, in fact, Zaphod's intention is to make more money and go back to a different dimension / Earth to pick up more people. So his intention was not to save these individuals, but that's where the computer took them. So there's the randomness of improbability back again.
His intent was to go to Ireland.
Right.
But he ended up in England, saving the group.
Yep.
Or being trapped with the group, waiting for the next person to arrive, which was Wahlbagger.
Who actually saves them, yes.
So Wildbagger shows up and decides that it's a great opportunity to insult Zaphod and calls him Stay-at-o-pegic.
Yes, could they found a more difficult way to say fat ass?
They did, yeah. And that causes Zaphod to threaten to kill him, mm-hmm. which is what he wants.
Right.
So that was kind of an interesting thing from the book, and I like how they kept it here and the way they did it. It was pretty funny. But I did not like that in pretty much consecutive sentences, Vogon Jeltz asks, which constant are you? And then when told, says, oh, that one. And right after that, Constant Moan calls him father. So he didn't even recognize his own kid.
Yes.
And another line from the book that mm-hmm. was buried and didn't jump out as being super intelligent or funny to me, which did in this, which is, dreams come true all the time, just not for the dreamers.
Oh boy, are we going to have a conversation about a piece of paper?
Soon, I'm guessing. Why?
Oh, why? Because what it's about the same concept. Same concept.
Oh, true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So they do a brief look into the interview Hillman Hunter is having to find a new god for Nano.
Yep.
And Hillman Hunter, since this is really where we meet him, is one of the people that Zaphod contacted to get a group of rich people together to go to this other planet to avoid the destruction of an Earth in their reality.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went back for a second group.
Yep.
It was the third group that he got trapped with in Stavromula's.
Mm-hmm.
He interviews Cthulhu, but dismisses him because he's only a great old one, not a god.
Right. Well, you know, that line about stacking their heads and, you know,
yes.
And destroying
skulls
their,
and, yeah.
You know, that could have influenced his opinion.
It could have, maybe a little bit. So Arthur gets cleaned up, and in the book, he is dressed in his size-appropriate but not age-appropriate school uniform.
Which I loved that part in the book. I thought that was funny.
I thought it was very funny,
mm-hmm.
except for the fact that it was never brought up again, except to say, oh, you've changed out of it. Like, it could have been a running joke.
Right.
The whole time. But
here in the radio show, he requests his old clothes back and gets a version of them.
He gets, yeah, he's wearing a dressing gown. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's got to be a middle ground. I guess I would have preferred that they kept the school uniform and then made jokes about his knees or his little cap or whatever.
Exactly. And that's why he says that he refused to wear them because he couldn't do it with those knees.
Right. Yes. And we've always talked about the left no joke go untold if it's been left out of things.
Right.
But sometimes they take things that they've already used and they just bring them back for no apparent reason. Like here at the end of the episode, they throw in the contraceptive in a time machine line.
Right.
I'm like, what does that have to do with anything in this story? It just didn't make any sense.
At that particular moment, isn't Zaphod being reintroduced to Wildbanger or something? I mean, that they're discussing his heritage and maybe they're trying to keep him informed.
Yeah, I think that could be. But still, it was... They brought up that he's the first, but his grandfather was the fourth or
right.
great, you know, it was yeah. just kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
So we get to part three, and this starts out with a passage from the book. In the book, it was a long, meandering guide note.
Ugh.
As I have been listening, I keep the book handy to see how true to the book it is.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a great example of them reading a guide note, cutting out all the needless lingual flourishings, and mm-hmm. getting right to the crux.
Right.
I'm not going to read the original guide note.
Good.
But this is what was said about the gods coming into existence.
Mm-hmm.
The gods came into existence moments after the Big Bang and thus did not create the universe, but vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Despite this, gods had a great time of it for millennia, worshipped for being all-knowing and all-seeing and impregnating the occasional mortal. But when science developed to the point where it could duplicate many of their tricks, blighting a crop was no longer a big deal. Virgin births became common. In fact, many societies preferred virgin births as they cut out the need for in-laws. Horrified, the gods retreated to their homeworlds, vowing never more to consult with mortals, except for the occasional impregnation. The actual expression was, "Mortals, screw them." And I'm like, so that was perfect to me. And I mm-hmm. loved every word in that sentence. And then I opened up the book to find that whole thing. It was about five times as long. And it did not include mortal screw 'em, I don't believe. It was, it's like, or if it did, it got lost.
Right.
It wasn't the punchline. It was just kind right. of thrown in there in the middle. So mm-hmm. again, that was very good for me.
Right. And here's that. I mean, that's a perfect example of what I had said earlier. That's Dirk. That's Dirk Maggs. I mean, I was trying to find some relevant information so I could probably talk to you or about him. And it's a little bit tedious, but I did see in an interview once that he was talking to people about reading a script. He was saying that he could tell whether it was a good script or a bad script within the first two pages. And okay. I think that he knew where the jokes were in the Owen Coffer version of this story. And mm-hmm. he did pull them out overall, I'd say, pretty successfully.
Yes.
And this, I think, is one of the good examples of it. The other thing I noticed here, which I really appreciated, this is the first part or point where the phrase porn wrangler is used. And
right.
it is definitely not belabored. It's, in fact, nope. I think, used about three, maybe four times in the whole radio show. And nobody brings up a big deal about any of it. So, you know.
And if I remembered, when it was presented the first time, it was almost like making fun of it for being yep. such a ridiculous word.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think at that particular moment, it's the computer prompting Arthur to use it in the conversation where he's to try and convince Wildbanger that he should head towards Nano.
Right, because the Vogons are going to attack.
Right.
And the reason he knows the Vogons are going to attack is because he was having his conversation with Fenchurch.
Mm-hmm. Fenchurch the computer.
Fenchurch the computer, correct. Right. Fenchurch was his computer, and as the computer, she appeared in a wet t-shirt, and he wanted to get a look at the Grebulons. Well, that's kind of a funnier sentence than I intended. So they kind of did an astral projection to Rupert to see what the Grebulons were doing, because that's when he saw that the Vogons were controlling the Grebulons and overheard the Vogons talking about this colony or colonies of Earthlings on this other planet. Mm-hmm. So he had to make Wildbagger go to Nano to save his people.
Right, right. And it's shortly after that, when he's yelling at them, is when Trisha first says the word Belgium.
Right. Yes, that was good.
I did notice one other contradiction between the book and the radio show here.
Okay.
When Zaphod is talking to Heimdall.
Right, on the Rainbow Bridge.
Heimdall says to him that Odin straight out tells him to kill him.
Oh.
And there's a big harangue in the book about that not being allowed, et cetera, blah, 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 blah. You know? Right.
That scene with Heimdall is one that I was hoping that they were going to take the opportunity to do a joke that I felt that they missed in the book. Because they did the exact same thing, where Heimdall told Zaphod, any question you could ask me, the answer would be no. And Zaphod keeps trying to ask a question. He's like, no, no. It's like Zaphod just say something like, are you going to try to stop me from crossing this bridge?
Right.
Like, do a question like that that's going to give the answer you want, something you want him to say no to.
Right. But they also didn't do that stupid, annoying heel clicking with the silver-tongued heels, etc. That part annoyed the heck out of me in the book.
He still yells out his phrase, though.
Yeah, the phrase, and I was okay with that, but at least the heel clicking stupidness wasn't there.
Right.
It's funny. I actually wrote my notes backwards. I listened to the first chapter and then the second one and then said, you know what? I'm going to try something different. And I went to 6 and worked 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All right.
So now I'm on 3 and I got to go back 3 pages to find my 4 notes.
So on the bridge, when Zaphod was trying to cross and they sent dragons to stop him, but for some reason he shouts out my compliments to the Underbrazier for no apparent reason. And the missiles were sent. Hel called Heimdall to locate the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And Hel wanted to know if Heimdall saw any aliens. And she worked in bejeweled battle shorts. So she wanted to know if there were any aliens there with wearing bejeweled battle shorts, and that made me happy.
Yep.
And then we learned that Wowbagger is not the first in his family to suffer immortality.
Yeah, that was weird.
And how Wowbagger became immortal.
Mm-hmm.
We also learned that he abandoned the alphabetical thing, and his first name is Balric, and Random laughs because he's Bow Wow Bagger.
Bow Wow Bagger.
And Random gets tubed.
Nothing about cutting off her finger, though.
No finger was cut off. I found this interesting. Back on the Business End, which is the name of the Vogon ship, Constant Moan, Vogon Jeltz's son, is writing in his secret diary. Or should I say, typing on a manual typewriter complete with the sound of a carriage return.
Oh my gosh. You know what's funny about that? The other day I was forced to try to have a conversation with T-Mobile, I think it was. And So I'm on the phone and I'm clearly talking to a computer as it's trying to get me to admit that I don't have a problem except being human.
Right.
And as you're talking to the computer, you hear, well, let me check that for you. Click, 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 click. I'm like, why? I'm not that stupid.
Well, it's like the ATM machines. The ruffling money sound that it makes that sounds like it's counting your money is not. It is just a sound that it makes to make you think it's counting your money before it spits out the money.
It's why?
So it makes typewriter or keyboard clicking sounds to make it sound more like it's a real person.
Mm.
Well, the end of part 3 is Random stealing Ford's Dino Charge card.
Yep.
We get to part 4. And this episode starts out including the passage about civilizations have risen and fallen, risen and fallen, risen and fallen from life, the universe, and everything. Right. And I'm not sure why they keep reusing bits from other books that they have used in the radio show.
Mm-hmm.
Is there not enough from this book to use that they need to add it with other material?
I don't know. But didn't you think it was funny that they had to add the cheering of the Asgardians here right at the beginning.
Well, yeah.
Give me an A! Give me a guard! What's that spell?
A Zagard. It's a Zagard. And then they had to think for a minute.
Yeah. Zagard.
Asgard!
Asgard! Oh, gosh. Funny radio stuff, but really dopey, huh?
Yes.
But I did like Thor's comment here. I mean, I know you're going to get to it. I love Thor's comment that he says to Zaphod, he said, you know, you're two-faced even though you only have one head.
Right. Right. Yes, that was good.
That was a good line. Now, tell me that was in the book, right?
Was not in the book. I am sure it was not in the book. I didn't look it up, but let me say that if it was, it was buried and lost between a bunch of nonsense.
Yep.
So Zaphod is looking for Thor. You know, this is before he gets to Thor.
Right.
And he's got to say these magic words to get a door to open. In the book, the door was guarded by a tree, and there was a drawn-out scene that ended with Zaphod saying, "Trees are fruity," which were the words.
Mm-hmm.
In this, there's no tree, and when he is told that there are magic words that he has to say to get the door to open, in frustration, he says, "Holy Zarquan, singing fish." And those were the magic words. That was so much better than "trees are fruity."
Yep, yep. I like that part. And of course, we finally get to Thor, and guess what? He's not playing chess.
No, he's also kind of whiny and sulky and not very majestic.
And we don't get any of the fun scenes that they do actually do in the book. Some of that stuff where he's being shrunk down and pushed around and all that kind of stuff was kind of right. Funny in the book. But again, the whole scene with the gods there was belabored, in my opinion. But they do much better job here in the radio show, I think. And doesn't he say that the video showed what, Thor in bondage gear wearing a diaper?
Yes. Yes. Yep.
And that image can't even look at him anymore. Is actually funnier than they say in the book.
Yeah. So this is the part where we get to listen to all of the inner thoughts or inner dialogues that the core group is having with themselves. So Wowbagger is debating whether or not he should have Thor kill him, or if he should be with Trillian. And he's going to outlive her like everybody else he has ever known. And Trillian is trying to decide if she can experience love at first sight with Wowbagger. And she reminds herself that she's dedicating herself to Random, and then it goes wrong. And Trillian is concerned about having a serious relationship. So it's this whole Random Wowbagger thing. And Random wants to help Wowbagger kill himself. So she does research on the Sabitha, and it told her that it is possible to kill an immortal. And she's learned how that can be done. And then Forge just wants to see how long he can go without blinking, and he's timed himself, and he can go 8 minutes. Isn't that cool?
Good old Ford.
Yeah. But Ford learned that he is no longer employed or active employee with the guide because his Dino Charge card was used before it was issued. I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, that's how Random retroactively uses it to buy the rubber bands.
Yes. And Arthur talks to Fenchurch, the computer, about how tough his life is and is told that he actually has it pretty good. So on Nano, we learn that two groups of geriatric colonists have servants in tow that were brought to the planet by Zaphod, and that they both need a deity, and the leader of the second group decided that it would be Cheese.
And they've stolen the chef.
From the first group, yes.
And for some reason, there's only one chef. I haven't got that far yet, but...
Right, yeah, well, there's only one.
Right.
They can't have him back until they bend the knee to the Cheese. And a militia was formed, but all the servants, who were much younger, deserted to the beach, and the colonists had to cook for themselves or eat the instant meals Zaphod left. Algolian Zylback burgers, smothered in Vulcan dodo spit, which some consider a delicacy. I did find this line to be funny when they were describing the burger.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a meat burger made from the most unpleasant parts of a creature well known for its lack of any pleasant parts.
Oh my gosh.
So I always like when they do at least come very close to the type of humor that Douglas conveyed.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Here's one of the things that I kind of didn't like how it was done in the book, and they kept it here. So Hillman is playing Acide's recorded ultimatum, and in it, Acide says, "E damnation."
Mm-hmm.
And Hillman says, "Ridiculous." Well, I thought it would have been better, since later we learn that they're the same person, if he thought it was brilliant. If he would have gone, "E damnation, brilliant." But it's because they're the same person.
Right, you think exactly. That
they would like the same things. So they do a guide note, and it's about the ultra warm beast. And it lives in total isolation from the outside world.
Oh, right.
It has to live in isolation from the outside world in order to exist,
mm-hmm.
because no outside influences can happen, so it can ponder the imponderable. But what could it possibly think about if it has always been isolated? If it knows nothing outside of it, what is there to ponder?
Oh, its own existence.
Well, it's like
we know what a whale would do, and even a bowl of petunias. But now we're wondering about an ultra warm beast.
Well, the whale saw the ground. This ultra warm beast is closer to cricket.
Mm-hmm.
Like they had no idea. They weren't pondering any imponderables because there was nothing else. It was only cricket.
So this is like an individual sitting in a sensory deprivation tank, not knowing anything exists beyond that. I didn't really get this whole part of this. That's why I wrote my note. I didn't get any of this. I don't understand what the point of this was.
Yeah. Take a baby that's just born and put it in a sensory deprivation tank and let it grow up and exist through some kind of feeding and air breathing thing. But what's it going to think about? Nothing. Nothing.
Isn't that what most people think about?
Yes. Nothing and sex.
Right.
Those two things.
Those two things. Oh, my gosh. And then don't we go, this is where I have a question for you, Jeff. This next series of conversations and sequence, I don't remember from the book, where Ford and Arthur are trying to get off the ship. Is this an all radio show production? I'm talking about Eccentrica.
Oh, about the cloud?
And Eccentrica Galumbitz.
No, the Eccentrica Galumbitz thing I do not believe happened.
Mm-hmm. This part I wondered about because I'm sure I didn't take notes well enough to get through it, but it was one of the more interesting parts of the radio show. But I swear I don't remember any of this in the book.
I don't know what they did in the book for this part. Do you know what I mean?
I don't have any recollection of it.
So Ford goes into Arthur's room to use the computer that is keyed into Arthur's mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because he doesn't want to just stand idly by.
Right, right.
And he wants to get his dino charge card reinstated.
Right, so they're trying to figure a way off the ship.
Right, and Ford wants the computer to go into his mind and use thoughts that he can't access and figure out some way. And the way Fenchurch appeared for Arthur, Eccentrica appeared for Ford. With her deep voice.
Right. And then they have this little bit of information that they talk about Eccentrica and how no one has ever actually stayed with her for an entire night.
No.
And Ford was, what, there for only a few hours, I think he says.
Or 30 minutes or 30 something
minutes
like
or
that.
So. Yeah, right. Exactly. That was kind of an interesting little tidbit as it goes.
Mm-hmm.
But then the computer sends Arthur and Ford back into their own past to look for the help that they want in order to get off the ship.
Yes. And they seem to be on prehistoric Earth. And up the slope of the hill, there's a cloud. And this was a great line. Mm-hmm. As they're approaching, Arthur says that the closer that they get to the cloud, the more it looks like fog. And Ford told him, that pretty much defines a cloud.
Yeah, it helps with the haplessness of Arthur.
Yes. And then they meet a man dressed in black on a horse wearing no clothes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, see, I guess if they said what the man was wearing, I guess they were going to say what the horse was wearing.
Exactly. The horse wasn't wearing any clothes. The horse with no clothes. Now, really, is the dog's name Bingo or is it the farmer? Because I know everybody says it's the dog, but the way the statement goes, it could be the farmer.
That Bingo was his name-o?
Yeah, there was a farmer, had a dog, and Bingo was his name-o. The farmer could have been named Bingo.
The farmer could have been Bingo.
This is a horse with no clothes, Jeff.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. By the way, I really love this scene. And I thought as soon as they saw the guy on the horse, I thought, uh-oh, here's Jeff's favorite character back again. It's the ruler of the universe. It's the...
The man from the asteroid. But no, it wasn't.
Mm-mm, no, it wasn't.
Well... He is a consultant in all matters with a specialty in where things ought to be.
Right. The right place or the wrong place.
Yes. So he took a piece of paper and he put it in Arthur's pocket and said, seek and you shall find.
Right. That's what the paper says when they finally look at it. But there's a long conversation about the paper having different meanings in different places. And in one place, it was a coupon for a free pop-up toaster.
Yep.
In another place, it was a ticket to the greatest comic operas.
Right. But I liked everything about that bit.
Right. And basically what it comes down to is what it means depends on where it is.
That was one of those, I could sit down and think about that all day.
And of course, they did have to play it up there, because then he starts laughing about the concept of God, and he says, God strike me down, and then he immediately gets struck down.
Don't jump to any conclusions!
I thought that was nice at the end. This was funny. And again, I'm going to give all praises. All praises to Dirk. All praises to Dirk. I'm going to start a cult, Jeff.
Okay. So we're going to go back to Nano for one moment, and the two groups are going to clash and have their battle as the Heart of Gold arrives and a giant wheel of cheese appears in the sky.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that exciting?
So part five.
The very beginning of part five, at least as I recall in my notes here, they talk about the Dentrasi.
Correct.
Again, my favorite character name, or actually a species name that I think that they use within there. And of course, they go through a whole big harangue about them being research dentists that figure out that everything on their world causes tooth decay, including toothpaste. And then they become mentally unstable, and then they say screw it and just become party animals that like to cook. But they don't have any feature in this story.
Right. So they do a big, long excerpt on the Dentrasi, and they play no part in the story. See, now, I thought you would be bothered by this explanation.
Well, yeah, I mean... It was silly and overwrought, but it was kind of funny. You know, it's the kind of thing that Douglas Adams would do. You know, he'd throw you a curveball. And that is not really true, because at one point earlier in the episodes, Ford is talking to Arthur about getting off the Earth, and he mentions that the Dentrassi are no longer on the Vogon ships. So right. They are actually mentioned. They're not featured, yep. But they are mentioned.
They're not featured, but they are mentioned. Well, the reason I thought you would be bothered is because in the first radio series, when they were talking about the Dentrassi,
mm-hmm.
you kind of figured that it's an interesting word. They're in the squalid bed thing. Detritus is all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So you thought that the Dentrassi was derivative of detritus.
Uh-huh, absolutely.
But he said it's dentistry.
You know, I didn't think about that. You're right. Now, see, that wouldn't... Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't think about that till you just mentioned it.
Well, they didn't actually say that their name is derived, but why would they all be dentists? And it's Dentrassi. I mean, it's like so on the nose. Where detritus,
mm-hmm.
you got to think about it a little bit. But,
right.
But this, to me, a little on the button.
I'll just say it's a translation error caused by my Babelfish.
Oh, perfect. So on Wahlbagger's ship, Trillian is scanning the planetoid Nano and found the settlements, and she discovered Thor was there, and she was all excited about Thor and wondered if he would remember her. And I guess if Thor is interested, that's it for Wahlbagger. Or maybe she figures she'll just end up with the winner of the fight.
Yeah, I thought that was a little funny.
Zaphod and Hillman meet, and Thor is introduced to Hillman as his new god.
Right, and here there was an interesting thing. Again, they imply it in the book. I don't think there was ever a direct exposure of this, and you mentioned it also. But here, Zaphod just flat out says, Hunter, Preflux is you from another
right.
dimension. I mean, just flat yes. out says it. You
flat
know?
Out says it, yeah.
And that was interesting. And, of course, right after that, we meet our friends, the talking cows.
Right. Wahlbagger lands in the field of cows.
Mm-hmm. Those cows.
And he impresses a seed because he knows the great cheese.
Mm-hmm.
So during the arguments by the cows to be eaten, one demands to be barbecued right away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's struck by lightning. And that's the second lightning strike joke of the series.
Mm-hmm.
It is decided to state here that there has been no exploration of the relationship between Zaphod and Trillian because they are of different species and there are laws against unnatural practices. The Book of Laws, which describes all the unnatural practices, is pure pornography. When Zaphod and Trillian meet on Nano, Zaphod basically embarrasses himself and gets turned down. But on this unnatural practices thing, it really doesn't make a lot of sense because there's nothing historical about different species. Like in all of the worlds that they have gone to, I've always imagined it to be a conglomeration of a whole bunch of different people.
Right. Right.
But if you do remember, they wouldn't crossbreed Trillian at the fertility clinic.
Right, right. But then again, those squid on that luxury hotel planet were more than willing to be used in unnatural ways.
Yeah. Well, especially if you were a movie producer or something.
Music producer, right.
Music producer, right. Right.
And then, of course, there's
kazoos.
Yeah, and there's, of course, Random and her gerbil.
Yes, there is. Flaboos.
But, you know, that's in a construct of their own thinking. But I did think it was funny that here in this episode, Zaphod refers to something as steampunk technology.
Yes. Yes, that was funny. Here's something that I found interesting. So Zaphod and Arthur are arguing over the arrival of the Vogons.
Mm-hmm.
And Zaphod is using more monkey comments. And Arthur told him that he would stick one of his opposable thumbs in Zaphod's good eye. Which means he's wearing the eye patch, like he did in the TV series. And the one with the eye patch is the one that never talked.
Right. Right. So was that his left head? No, that would have been his right head, I guess.
That would have been his right head. So the left brain in the TV show is the head that we had all the interaction with.
Mm-hmm.
But it was cut off in the book because it had no control.
Mm-hmm.
But that would have been the right head. So it's all backwards.
It reminds me of young Frankenstein and Igor's hump.
Yes, it keeps jumping from side to side.
Wasn't that on the... Oh, no, never mind. Oh, gosh. But you know what? I was kind of bothered a little bit in the radio show about the announcer guy talking about how the fight was going to proceed. With, you know, 15 rounds and knockouts mm-hmm. and all this kind of crap and the Queensbury rules. And I mean, that was silly and not
the And it purpose. Was Ford.
Yeah, and it was not the purpose.
Ford was the announcer.
Not the purpose of this particular fight.
No, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. There was no rounds or rules.
But it was kind of funny that, was it Ford that suggested they might be able to use a wet towel, snapping a wet towel yes. in the battle?
So the U-Bid delivery ship arrives and delivers their last package ever to Random, which was the pair of rubber bands
mm-hmm.
that she asks Thor to put on his hammer.
All right. Relax. They're rubber bands, Jeff. And Thor's hammer may be large, but I'm sure they fit.
Yes. Oh. And I liked in the scene where Wildbagger says the worst possible things to Trillian, she calls him a Beeblebrox voter.
Mm-hmm. Oh gosh, and it is kind of funny. I do like the way that when Random is describing getting the rubber bands from the temple, she says, well, it's more like a fairground attraction.
Right. Yeah.
But at the end of the fight, I thought it was kind of interesting here. I mean, they sort of implied this in the book that Thor hit him hard enough to knock the immortality out of him. But in the book, the ship fixes him back the way he was. He becomes immortal again.
Does he?
Yeah. Yep.
I don't remember that. I thought he was happy.
Yeah, they
now
put him in the med bay. The med bay actually fixes
him. That was Hillman. Did Hillman go in the med bay?
Yeah, Hillman goes into the med bay and gets the goat legs.
Right. That does not happen in this.
Right. But that's actually on the Heart of Gold med bay.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
So you're saying in the book,
Wildbagger
goes and gets his immortality back.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he does.
Okay. That's sad.
Yeah, it is.
Because this was brilliant how he went into this fight with Thor. Thor knocks the immortality out of him. He can now live a natural life with Trillian
mm-hmm.
and grow old together.
Right. Right. And Zaphod says to him as she's leaving, will you miss me? Oh, gosh. What an ego.
Yeah. So there was a part in here I liked with Thor and Arthur meeting, and Thor thought that Arthur looked vaguely familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he found out who Arthur was, he was actually impressed that he bested him at that party. And not many people best him because
right.
then he kills him.
Yep. Yep. That's pretty cool. Have we made it to the final and sixth chapter of this book
just yet? Just about. There's one more thing.
Okay.
We really don't do any of our questionable answers after these.
Mm-hmm.
But the end of chapter 5 after the credits, or during the credits, did pose a question that I thought I would ask you.
Okay.
Does a forlornest fire dragon leave lava piles in the woods?
I don't know. Ask a bear.
Ask a bear. So that now brings us to part six. So they describe the Vogon Bureau Cruiser basically as an ugly ship with lots of high-tech gizmology and advanced weaponry.
Mm-hmm.
And it arrives to Nano, and it's about to torpedo the colonists when Moan told Jeltz to wait. There's a Class 1 immortal on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeltz is actually pleased because he can use his secret experimental weapon.
Right.
And he launches torpedoes that look like flying horses to distract the immortal.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two things that happen right here that I don't recall if from the book, but I don't recall Jeltz making an announcement from his ship to the nanites.
That, I don't remember that either.
And he makes an announcement that he's going to destroy their world or whatever.
Right.
And then the other thing is, as Thor is flying up into the sky, he's got wind in his hair and bugs in his teeth.
Yes.
Which I thought was kind of funny.
Right. So right when Arthur and Random decide that they're going to make a life on this planet,
mm-hmm.
Ford shows up and tells them that they have to leave because, according to the guide, the Vogons are here. And Arthur says that the guide always lies and cites as an example the passage about flying where you throw yourself at the ground and miss. He can fly. And that's how he did it.
Right.
So why is he using that as the example of the guide lying? Because he threw himself at the ground, got distracted, and missed exactly how the guide described how to do it.
Right, right. That's interesting. I didn't catch that, but it makes me wonder. I mean, I know we get these things all jumbled up, but he did have that flying episode in the radio show.
Oh, absolutely. A couple of times.
Yeah.
He and Fenchurch flew all over.
Right, exactly. That's weird.
And then on Life with the Cricket Men, that's how, I mean, he's flying with the olive oil and all that
Retsina,
stuff.
Retsina,
so, yeah. Yeah, the Retsina.
Oh, my gosh.
So Thor takes on the business end. Again, a funnier sentence than I ever really intended.
Oh, gosh, that's great.
And Zaphod told him to be either a hero or a martyr.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeltz launches his quest torpedo. Thor went to disable it, and Jeltz detonated it. And Zaphod caught Thor's helmet on his head.
Right. Yeah, this was interesting, because in here, in the radio show, again, I know there's a difference between the narrative approach of a radio show to a written approach of the book, but right. Here Zaphod says that he sold the quest to the Vogons specifically because he knew he would have to protect himself from the
correct
Vogons, which I thought, well, that's a little odd. I mean, I understand him selling the quest bomb, and they don't make the jokes in the radio show about the jelly and all that kind of stuff, but I didn't get this part, why Zaphod thought that it would protect him from the Vogons.
Well, I guess it does go to his ego.
Yeah, I guess.
Moan prevents Jeltz from finishing off the nanites by pointing out that they are no longer earthlings and owe back taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And like in the book, something that I thought was way out of place and overdone, Jeltz likes to show appreciation and affection to his crew with a little head rubbing. And the squeaky little greasy pate head rubbing is just happening over and over again, which mm-hmm. I wouldn't have expected.
No. No one expects. Oh, God, I'll try it again. No one expects a good head rubbing.
No. No. Hope for. But not expected. God.
Oh, my word.
So Zaphod leaves Nano right away because he does not want to deal with the fallout from his antics with Hillman and some of the women.
Right.
He got a message from Thor saying that he was alive and got his hint about being a martyr.
Mm-hmm.
So like you said about Zaphod selling the quest to the Vogons, Left Brain was astonished that Zaphod would sell a bomb. And Zaphod said he sold them a dud. And then he said, before your time, Left Brain. So when Zaphod only had one head, he sold a bomb or a dud to the Vogons. Then he acquired a second head, did all this stuff that we know about, then removed his head, and the bomb was used.
No, don't think too kindly on that one.
So here's another bit of logic from Zaphod that escapes me.
Okay.
Like in the book, he wants to run for president again.
Mm-hmm.
But the current president is the headless one, who he made fun of during the campaign. And he's going to have to get that current president to reduce his class one felony to class two or something like that. And Zaphod, like I said, was harassing him during the campaign with his two heads are better than none slogan. And Left Brain tells Zaphod that he needs something to bribe this new president with, but he's already got a lot of money. And Zaphod says, I know just the thing. Thor's helmet. For the guy with no heads. I don't think that's going to work.
No, I don't think that would appeal to him.
So here's where they start tying it up with a great big bow.
Mm-hmm.
So Random decides to apply for citizenship to Nano and get a virtual degree. She agrees to be Hillman's assistant, so basically she's going to do all his work for him.
Right.
Arthur wants to go on a trip. He said he missed
hitchhiking. Yeah, that didn't work for me. I was a little bothered by that.
Aside from the first hitchhike with Ford, did he ever hitchhike? He was paying for upgrades with deposits.
I guess he was hitched. Yeah, you're right. He was paying for it. Don't know.
There was. Yeah. He didn't have electronic thumb. So I don't know if he ever really...
No, they don't talk about that at all.
Yeah.
I mean, they could have replaced mistraveling with hitchhiking, because you're right, he's not actually hitchhiking.
Right.
That's one word in there that kind of bothered me, you know, but...
Yeah, me too.
It bothered me.
So Ford got his job back, and he's going to explore and report on every avenue of pleasure on Nano.
Right. And this is, again, a little bit weird, because he says that he's going to report about the high end and the low end of hitchhiking. And I'm thinking to myself, that doesn't jive either. What's a high end hitchhiker? A mooch? Mooching?
Yeah. Arthur had made the comment about the 30 Altarian dollars a day.
Right.
And he said that with the fluctuation of that currency,
mm-hmm.
it could be vastly different amounts of money. Mm-hmm. It can be nothing, or it could buy you a house.
Right.
That was his...
justification for what he was doing. Yep.
Yep, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And Arthur is making one last jump through hyperspace and gets a quick meeting with Fenchurch, and then he fades away.
Right. Ends up back on his beach.
I guess what I did not totally realize in the book, and it is in the book, that it is at this point... that Fenchurch says the title.
Right. That's true.
Arthur is in hyperspace. All of a sudden, he's with Fenchurch, who's in the middle of a conversation. And the first words she says are, and another thing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize it before with the book because I closed myself off by the time we got here. But Fenchurch is the one that says the line that the title of the book.
You're right.
So I like that. finding out in the radio show that
right, she was in the middle of a conversation with Arthur, and that was the words that were coming out of her mouth when she disappeared. So it's funny. So Fenchurch does play a critical role in the existence of the book, but of course she's not in the book except for the computer generated image of her. But then here at the end, after Arthur disappears off of the hyperspace flight that he's on, he reappears on his beach.
Right.
Near the Holy Lunching Friars of Boone. And he sees in the distance the shack that he was living in.
Right. He said, I recognize that hut. He found the beach with the hut that was in the construct that the Guide Mark II did.
Right. He gets... Well, and we don't really know this for a fact. We don't know exactly what happened to him when he gets zapped out of hyperspace. I mean, he could be literally back in the same construct for all we know.
Right.
Walks into the shack and he sees a manifestation of, well, not a manifestation, but a physical presentation of Marvin.
Right. Marvin's there.
Who's been reconstructed with a new body. His personality, et cetera, has been switched into this new body. All this bad luck that's been compiled onto Arthur at this moment causes a vortex or a reversal of a A.G. Rudjag's luck, or as we know him, Agrajag, in another plane of existence where he now has won the lottery, become a millionaire, awoken from a long coma, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a good luck fortune for him, and that's where the book ends.
Right.
But the radio show gives us one more step.
Yes. And
that's the step that Arthur takes into his shack. And who's there but...
But Fenchurch.
Fenchurch. Fenchurch is there. And this in phenomenal good luck reverses our friend A.J. Rajag's luck. And he becomes covered in barbecue sauce and fed to the bug platter beast of Trawl.
Yes, and that was it for him.
That's right. But I you know, one other thing. I'm sorry.
Did you just kind of say, and another thing?
No. Well, close. One of the things that I also like about this is that they call their production unit the perfectly normal production.
Right.
I thought that was quite brilliant. And I don't remember that in the original radio shows, do you?
No, I don't know if it started with Life, the Universe, and Everything, or if it started with this one. I don't remember when they became a perfectly normal production.
Right. So here we are with our hero slash Arthur.
Right.
Living in a shack with Marvin and Fenchurch.
Right.
And what do we have but questions?
Yes, we do have lots of questions. Same questions we had at the end of the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So do we have answers to those questions, Jeff?
We do not have any answers to those questions. At least I don't.
But do you think they exist?
Well, that's a pretty good lead-in to our next episode, except I don't think it's going to give us any answers to this.
Do we ever get an answer? I mean, we do get an answer. We know the answer. The answer is 42. But
the answer is 42.
It's left with nothing but questions.
And our next episode is going to be about the radio series number 7 called Apocryphal Phase.
And that's not based on any written word that we know.
No. So it is going to be a complete and total mystery, and we will, I don't know what we're going to do. What are we going to do?
We will decipher the mystery as we listen.
Yes, we will.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, Brian, now that we know what's happening next time, I'm just going to say this is the end. There's a part in here where Thord. There was a part.
I'd like a new character, please.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get a little punchy, don't we?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for listening to Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea.
Look for us the first Thursday of every month for a full episode. We will also release a bonus episode later in the month. A very special thanks goes out to Luke, Max, Greg, and Tim Lesnick for arranging and performing our opening theme. We would also like to thank our talented friends and family for their voice work on our introductions and commercials. Visit our website at digitalwatchesareaprettyneatidea.buzzsprout.com, where you can find links to all my Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy-inspired t-shirt designs. You can find us on Facebook and YouTube as Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea, on Instagram at Watches Idea Podcast, and on Twitter, or should I say X, at Watches Idea. If you'd like to contact us, our email is digitalwatchespodcast@gmail.com.
This has been a Fruits for Thought production.